This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, the podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. Jill is a funeral director, and in this interview, she talks about the various aspects of her vocation, including the care funeral directors provide to the recently deceased and their families.
So you're up north, and you're a funeral director.
I am. I'm newly minted funeral director. I came into this late last year. It had always been something that had been on my mind to do, but it is a 24/7 job, and if you're raising a family you have to be in the right space to do it. And I also think that I don't know if I would have had the sort of the life experience, the empathy, or just to do the sort of mahi earlier in my life. I'm in my early 50s now, and I'm so pleased that I reached out to some of the funeral directors up here and put myself forward. It's one of those peculiar professions where you can't get your qualifications until you've been working for 12 months. So you kind of have to, prove that you are capable of doing what it takes. As it turns out, I must have been, because I'm still there.
What drew you to this profession when you were younger? What fascinated you about this kind of work?
I've thought about that myself, Andrew, quite a bit. I mean, it's not just that I was a Cure fan when I was in high school, I'm sure. It's the great mystery and the great inevitability. And it's this extraordinary, and it is an undertaking. I can see why it has been called, well, it was called that in New Zealand. Not very many people call themselves undertakers. It is the mahi itself is an undertaking. Please excuse my very noisy cat in the background too. You can edit him out later. So I've always been quite fascinated by it. And the older we get, the more death becomes a presence. It's just inevitable. I guess it's data and statistics. The more people we know that get older, the more likely they are to pass away. And I just found the role of the funeral director in funerals that I'd attended a calling or a public service, or I don't, without sounding too grandiose, in some ways it is. And I sort of discovered there were two very distinct kinds of people when I was putting this idea that I would like to work in that field. There's one type of person just does not want to know. They could be anybody. There are people that they do not want to know anything about death, dying, or the processes that surround that. And then there's people who are fascinated. I've been surprised. Some people I thought were quite sort of open-minded have just gone, oh, my Lord, I don't want to know anything about it. I'm obviously in the second camp. I've always found it fascinating. The actual mechanics of death don't sort of bother me. And I guess it just stuck with me. And I thought, right, I'm in my 50s. It is one of the very rare occupations that being a middle-aged woman sends you to the front of the line as opposed to the back of the queue. So there was that.
Is that because not a lot of people want to do this kind of work?
It is, yes. And it is a certain type of person, I guess. And I consider myself to be very non-judgmental and to have empathy. I'm sure most people want to think that of themselves, of course. But you have to approach every family and every deceased person with completely open eyes and a completely open mind. It can be challenging, of course, but it sort of drew me in. I got the opportunity to do some work experience. The colleagues that I was working with thought I was in a good role. They said, "You can do this, Jill." I had to go through quite a lot of psychological testing and whatnot with the firm that I am employed by. They take that very seriously because, I mean, I guess you can guess why some people are perhaps not either capable of dealing with what we deal with on a daily basis, or perhaps they're doing it for the wrong reasons. So, but I got through all those hurdles and I feel as though I found my vocation, really. It's such important work. And it is the great mystery. And I've always been fascinated by mysteries and not frightened of. I find people that work in palliative care, in hospice, and I think those people are heroes. That is not something, I couldn't lend myself to that. But when a person passes away, I think it's a massive privilege to be a part of honouring that person in the best way that they can be for them and for their families. It's the element of ritual appeals to me. Of a service or in what we do. It is a fascinating process, both from the point of view of how our bodies break down after we die. So on that sort of very mechanical level, it's pretty fascinating. But also the process of like paperwork and how to have somebody cremated, you do have to jump through an awful lot of hoops, and you can understand why. It's an extremely final thing, and you can only do it once. So I like to think that I try to get it right for the person who's passed and for the family that remains, or their loved ones that remain.
So before we move forward, let's just go back a step, and can you explain mm-hmm. what you mean by mystery?
Well, I'm not a religious person. I am not even what I would say, I'm not an agnostic. I'm not particularly spiritual, but I like to think that I'm not pompous enough to think I know everything there is to know. It's the last sort of taboo, I think, the great unknown. What really does happen when we die? And being part of that process and helping people, because I think being a funeral director is you're navigating families and grief, and sometimes it's horrific and dreadfully unfair, and sometimes it is a beautiful, well-lived life, and a well-lived person is honoured well. And you have to navigate absolutely everything in between that. But the mystery is, it's all the same. And we don't know why. If somebody could tell me, I'd be very surprised. I mean, I read a lot, and I love my philosophy, and I love different points of view. One of the great joys that I've had is dealing with people of different faiths and their customs. Really fascinating and really important to get right for those people because it's honouring their tikanga, and it doesn't matter if you're a a Sikh or a Muslim or a Christian, a Catholic, a spiritualist, or you're not affiliated to a religion. It's the closest that I think a lot of people get to that sort of consideration. And I find that extraordinary.
Do you notice, is there a difference in the way that people and from different cultures respond to death? Say, let's just say a generalized version of Pākehā versus Māori culture, or say Sikh culture.
There is. How people respond to death is very circumstantial. I mean, I think in Māori culture, because a lot of the tradition is to keep a family member home with them until they're taken to their urapā, they're more comfortable around the deceased in general than your average, you know, Pākehā New Zealander from. I mean, I remember my grandparents dying in the 80s, and you'd go to a nice service. They'd probably been embalmed, so you would maybe view them if you felt like it. There'd be a nice 45-minute service at the Methodist church and some lovely rousing hymns, and then off they'd go, and that was it. And it felt, even back then, as a teenager, I remember thinking, is that it? Is that it? And I do think Māori, the mourning and the grieving process is really extraordinary. Even looking into all sorts of different tikangas, different traditions, Māori culture is they grieve really well through that process. It allows people to mourn and grieve, and the ritual of keeping somebody at home. And look, I'm not suggesting that it's all Māori families do that, because they certainly don't. And circumstances of the death can change and alter that, which can be very painful for people wanting to stick with their traditions. If they can't, for simple reasons to do with the condition of the deceased. Breaks my heart if people have to have their loved ones taken away for the coronial process, for example. But it is so necessary. And at the end of the day, I think most people, they absolutely want to know why somebody has passed away. But it is quite heartbreaking trying to explain to, say, the family of a child who's died of sudden infant death syndrome, of SIDS, saying, we have to take your child. They have to go to the coroner. And they're like, no, I don't. It's very sad. But it is. So all those mechanics and navigating them, that's sort of the trickiest part of the job, the embalming and washing, the dealing with the deceased is something that we do very gently and with a great deal of reverence. And I think across the board, everybody I've come into contact with that works in this, I hesitate to use the word industry, but in this work space, are aware of that. And there's so much kindness shown. Pretty remarkable people, I think, working in this industry. Because of where I'm located and because I'm pretty green to this and new off the block, I haven't had an enormous amount of different cultural or different religious funerals or funeral rites to take into account. The odd one, and they've just been magnificent. And I think the most important thing for a family who's grieving and for a funeral director that is helping that family make this quite possibly the worst day of their life into something special and worthy of the person that's passed on is assume nothing and learn everything. Every family I talk to, I'm like, I'm going to assume absolutely nothing. You tell me what you need to have done, and I will try and my best to make that happen. And that's what we do. And it can be challenging. And like I say, sometimes you're dealing with people that a lot of people just, I think the statistic actually that I heard was that you need to arrange or be involved in the arranging of a funeral in any capacity, whether it's a burial or a cremation, 2.4 times in your life, which is not much. For most people, the first instance of that will be probably when their parents die and all of a sudden they've got to arrange a funeral and nobody knows where to start. I do think that's a little bit sad because the process itself can be quite shocking to people. Just an example, and this is for legal reasons, if somebody is going to be cremated, you do have to ask their next of kin some really uncomfortable questions about, and you have to say it verbally, and this is just a legal process. You have to ask whether is there any chance that whoever the deceased was may have been poisoned, a victim of violence, a victim of, when it's, you know, it could be their 96-year-old mum who's just passed away peacefully in a rest home, but you still have to go through these weird little, jump through these hoops, and it can be quite confronting. I think it would, without fail, people are like, wow, that's a lot of paperwork, and those are crazy questions. It's just like, it is, but it's a very final committal, cremation, so they do make sure that you're extremely thorough before you agree to engage with that family and carry through on the wishes of their loved one. Mm.
I guess, is there a difference between, say, somebody who's been dying and they've gone through a process, they've had their diagnosis, they've got a terminal illness, and the family has months or weeks to figure this all out and to come to what's happening, and then of course the person dies and then the funeral director steps in. That process is compared to a sudden death or an unexpected death, like in a car accident, or infant death syndrome, or somebody who's has a massive heart attack and just keels over. Especially as regards younger people as well. Is the process for you different?
It can be. And I mean, I think we have, simply because of the demographic where I work, we do have a lot of older people, and quite a few of them have already come to see us. If they've had a diagnosis, they may come in to see a funeral director and say, I want to organise this now. This is what I would like to happen. And they may prepay for a funeral so they don't organise that so the family don't have to worry about it. But they generally have a fair idea. But when they're gone and you bring the family into the picture, they may just say, okay, we know Dad wanted to be cremated. It's like, okay, what happens before then? What happens before? There's a lot to happen before then. And it's then that a lot of people get sort of a bit bamboozled. It's like, I don't know, what's the difference between a committal and a memorial service or a direct or a what do we have to do? And it is entirely up to the individual families. It is very different when somebody is expected to pass. There's usually been some thought about it. Some people, even in a terminal illness, don't want to really talk about it or think about the mechanics of their passing or when they've passed until it's happened, you know, until maybe 2 weeks when they realise, oh, there's no getting out of this. We've actually had some very joyful conversations with people who were planning assisted dying, so terminally ill people that were like, okay, I've decided to go out, you know, assisted, a medically assisted death. And those people, they've lost their squeamishness, or obviously if they're planning to, regardless of what people's opinions are on assisted dying, those people have come to terms with it already and seem to be pretty okay, but they can't control what happens when they have passed. So they want to have a hand in, and I think that's marvellous. I think that's quite a lovely thing. If there's sudden deaths, yes, we generally cope, and people are in shock, extremely grief-stricken, and you just have to hold their hands and coach them through the process quietly, with as much dignity as you can give the person who is deceased. Yeah, people that have been sick for a long time, they probably have thought about it. And I hope people do talk to their families, because those that are still around and organising these send-offs for their loved ones, they do want to do what's best. They really do. And often families will come together, and there's been, you know, factions and ruckus over the years, as, you know, give me a perfect family, it's unlikely. And occasionally we will have to be stern and say, you need to put this aside and think about your mum or your dad or whoever it is. And sort of usher them through that. And I haven't...
How do people respond to that?
Pardon, Andrew?
How do people respond to that if there is a disagreement in the family and you're trying to settle that? How do they respond to you?
Well, we've had... Usually they're relatively chastened and can get on with it, if you like. We do have to say we're dealing with... this is a time-sensitive thing as well. If you don't want an embalm, you need to make decisions quite quickly. If you do want an embalm, it's going to give you a little more leeway, but there's going to be more cost. It's the mechanics of the body breaking down that people kind of don't want to think about, and I understand that. I mean, it's hard to see the person that you loved as just a vessel or a body, and we're very mindful of that, but we're very straight up and say, hey, you need to put this aside because mum, dad, uncle, koro, whatever, he's going to start to deteriorate and we need to get on with this. And people are generally like, oh, okay, it does put them back in the room. It's rare for that to happen, Andrew. Most people just need to know what happens next and how to go about doing that, and of course how much it costs, which is a major factor for a lot of people, because I know there's a cost of living crisis, but dying isn't particularly cheap in New Zealand either.
Okay, well, you've just brought up a whole series of questions. I've been making notes, but I want to go back to let's start with assisted dying, for example.
Yes.
Things I've learned through the course of the Last Breath series is that people have to be very cautious about that decision, because they're aware that there are members in their families who have an opposing view and don't like the idea of assisted dying.
Absolutely.
They want to avoid debates and argument. You know, they're making one of the hardest decisions of their life, well, the penultimate decision of their life, and they don't want conflict. Do you ever have circumstances where somebody has made a wish for their death, saying, this is how I want to, this is my service, and this is what I want. I want to be cremated or buried in this way. And after they've died, another family member steps in who might have, a more strident religious view, and who says, well, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do it this way.
Yes, that does happen. And it does come down to who the executor of the will is and who the immediate next of kin are. There is a pecking order. And we have to, as funeral directors, go, okay, who is the one person that is legally? Those are the decisions that we must legally abide by. And it can cause, divisions in families, but they tend to only be where they were already existing. In my limited experience, when that has happened, I haven't had anybody object to somebody be their ultimate in committal, whether it is to the ground or they are cremated. Even if people were like disappointed that so and so is not going to end up in the family plot, or they might disagree, they may say that, but ultimately they do deal with it. Most families, I think, want to respect the wishes of those who have gone. I think it would be unusual for somebody to step up and go, absolutely not. We have had funerals where people have refused to show up because of the decisions that have been made, and that is that's their choice to do so. But I do think that's quite that's disappointing. It's disappointing for us as funeral directors, because we want to see that person that we've had in our care and looked after respected and sent off really well. It doesn't always happen. But it's so important for people to talk about this. That's my overlying opinion, is that if people don't talk about this with their families, and it just leads to so much guesswork. And I think if people make their wishes very clear and they discuss it and it's understood, there's no great, there's nothing to be argued with once somebody's gone. The most that I ever see from families is that if they do a big funeral, a big service, the one thing I hear, it'll be the most wonderful send-off that I'll hear muttered, or Mum would have been absolutely appalled at, you know, how much this catering for this, and Dad would just have said, drop me in a hole down the back of the farm. But it's that tongue-in-cheek sort of, it's the service itself and the send-off is an important part of the ritual. It's for the community to witness the family in their grief and be there to support them, and for the families to see the social groups in the community that has come out of respect to see that loved one on their final journey. And it does help with the process of grieving. I believe we do the odd memorial that might be 2 months after somebody has passed away, and it's just not the same, and that people have got on with their own lives. It's not that they're forgotten, it's just that raw grief isn't processed the same way into a mourning pattern, if that makes sense. It's an interesting observation. I've asked people that have been doing this for considerably longer than I have, which is most people in this work, and they're like, absolutely, that you're absolutely right. People, if they have, if they participate in that final rite, in whatever capacity, they can move from that abject grief into mourning. I do think that's part of the ritual and the importance of what I do, and what we do as a society for those that have gone.
Does anybody ever choose to have a very private death? I want to just be buried or cremated. I don't want to have a service. I don't want people to gather. I just...
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a number of options for families that... This, I see this mostly with perhaps people who have had dementia. To a lot of their families, they've already grieved for them. They lost them some time ago, and they're like, there's no point in making a fuss. Mum, dad, grandma, granddad, whoever would have hated it, and we will, in our role, we will transfer the deceased into our care and prepare them for cremation and burial, and we will see that person through that journey ourselves, completely privately. And then your ashes are returned to families, or the burial plot is done if it's a burial. And the families do their own thing. And I think... Yeah, and there are people that say, absolutely don't do anything for me, but really once they are gone, if the family need it for themselves, I believe it's something that it's important to do.
Mm. Okay. I want to move on to viewing the body, because I had a conversation this morning over coffee with a friend. When my father died 3 years ago, his body was on display in the house for, I think it was the best part of a week.
Right.
I didn't go to look at his body because I've never had any interest in seeing a person after they've died. It's just my instinctual feeling.
Absolutely. And that's a very valid one, and we wouldn't encourage anybody that understands that about themselves to attempt it, really.
But I have had this as the conversation this morning, as another point of view, and some people think it's absolutely necessary, and I can understand why, and it's very disrespectful if you don't go and see the body.
My opinion is that it is one of the most personal, private decisions that an individual can make. Some people are just absolutely not comfortable with death, and they don't need that. They understand that the person is dead. They want to remember them as they were alive, and that's that. And I absolutely respect that. It happens a lot. Not everybody is... death is extremely distressing for some people. I think it's entirely individual, and it's very personal. I would never suggest that you need to do that, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with not viewing. It can be a horrible experience for some people. If the death has not been kind to the body, we discourage it in a lot of cases. It's because people are not sure what they think they know what they would like to see, but it very rarely is what their expectations are. It's a tricky one. It comes down to mechanics. It comes down to, simple things like whether or not somebody is going to become a biohazard. Viewing we do very subtly. I did a funeral today that he was ready for viewing. He was in a beautiful room. He looked fantastic. Lying in glorious repose in his favourite clothes. And a lot of the family were like, well, we don't actually know if we want to see him. And I said, that's fine. You absolutely don't have to at all, but he is there if you would like to. Well, within half an hour, the entire family was packed into this room, absolutely outrageous laughter, and they just had a ball. which was, I'll say, having a lot of jokes in there for a family in grieving. And it was a nice thing for all of them. It was the lead up to, I don't know if I want to see him like that. That was the individual question that people had to ask themselves. And I think everybody was happy that they did. And there was no pressure put on anybody if they didn't. It's not, I don't see it as being disrespectful at all. It's completely personal choice. You don't want to haunt somebody's dreams. And some people really, death isn't kind to them. And we will be really honest with those families and say, listen, we don't think it's going to be spiritually, psychically, emotionally a good thing for you to have this person viewed. We try to, you know, manage people's expectations. And that can be absolutely heartbreaking if it's a sudden death. Or, I mean, there has been a case where a young person was killed in a car accident, and nobody would want to see that person, this vibrant young 20-something-year-old, in the condition that death had put them in. But they had some beautiful tattoos on one arm that was not affected in the crash. And we were able to essentially embalm that arm, and so the parents could come in and hold the hand for one last time, and that was all we could offer. And that turned out to be the right decision, and it was very important for them. I mean, that's obviously a pretty tragic death, but they knew it was her, so they could reconcile in their minds that she was gone. And that is important, I think, if it's an unexpected or a sudden death.
Mm. One point of view that was offered to me very recently was somebody said they had to view the body of a relative who had died in very bad circumstances.
Mm.
He said he was absolutely fascinated to see the blood and the scarring and the unpleasant things.
But he said, there's probably a job for him in the funeral industry.
But he said, I've always been interested in looking at dead bodies. And he's a very empathetic person. He's a very decent person. So I don't want anybody to take that the wrong way. But I found that quite an unusual perspective. And he did say to me, he said, is that wrong to feel that way?
No, it is not. I mean, I was in Las Vegas many years ago, and they had the exhibition Bodies. Are you aware of that, Andrew?
Yes, I am, yeah. Could you explain it, please?
So it was somebody, I believe he was a Chinese doctor, had invented a system for plasticizing essentially the different systems of the body. So the exhibition itself, and they are real bodies, and they make that very clear, people that have been donated to science. I think there was some scandalous thing about it, but nevertheless, that's not what we're discussing today. So you'd walk through and see a skeleton. Of course, most of us are familiar what that looks like. But then you would see the venous system or the digestive system, and they're perfectly plasticized. And do you remember the models that we had in high school biology class?
Hmm.
And you'd take off a liver and a spleen, and you'd essentially it was actual people's live, and I found it just fascinating. I found it absolutely fascinating. But some of the people I was travelling with were like, what is wrong with you? Why would you see that? But millions of visitors went through that exhibition, and I believe it just continuously travels to galleries and around the world. And It is fascinating. We are all made up of much the same stuff. When I started doing this mahi, I was very nervous about the embalming process or how I would respond viscerally to what we're not used to being confronted with. And I found myself just responding with real humanity and sorrow for them. So you do the best that you can. The process can be of embalming, it can be very straightforward, or it can be depending on the deceased and their condition and what they died from, can be very difficult. Most people have an idea from watching television shows and what a post-mortem looks like, but it really doesn't look like that. That can be a distressing thing for families if somebody does become a coronial case and they do need a post-mortem. In a lot of other countries, organs would be taken from the body and taken away, including the brain. And in New Zealand, because of our cultural practices, everything is put back into the body. So it's not something that I believe everybody should see or need to know about. I honestly, until my first embalm, did not know if I would be capable of doing it and being removed enough to do a good job. And my main concern was I wanted to do a good job for this person and for this person's family. As it was, I got through it and he looked wonderful. He looked considerably better than he did when he came into our care. So I was, from a your professional standpoint, I was pleased, and so were the family, and that's lovely. And obviously, they did want to see him; they wanted to view him. There's also, I think, that shows like that we see on television, 6 Feet Under, and there's one on Netflix, a Spanish a comedy one called Death Inc. Even New Zealand's casketeers, I suppose, don't give really a full picture. Their show's designed for entertainment. But would you want to see? Would you want to look? I would suggest most people don't. And that is perfectly understandable.
Now, we don't... Sorry, Jenny. We don't have to be embalmed, though, if we don't want to.
No, not at all. Not at all. The issue with not being embalmed, so if you wanted to be cremated, is that the body does begin to break down quite quickly. After death, things start happening in the body and they can be quite unexpected. So you really need to move on if somebody's going to be cremated and they don't want to be embalmed, it should be done within 48 hours. Mm. And that's a very short time period for families to get their heads around. I think there was quite a sort of a backlash in New Zealand about embalming from maybe 20 odd years ago, where they found that embalming fluid was leaching into streams and things near cemeteries and having an ecological impact. That's considerably less now, and in fact it's most of the chemicals that are used, they do break down and they're all naturally found anyway, so there's no poisoning of the environment anymore. The industry has stepped up, have heard what people are saying and stepped up and found better chemical processes, better ways to do the same thing without anything toxic.
Now that's very interesting, because that was my own personal objection to embalming. I wouldn't want to put embalmed and then put in a hole and then be toxic to the environment.
Exactly. And it was, Andrew, it was mine too until I started doing this work. And I said it to my, and I got served by my colleagues. They went, that. So they went and they were like, why would you think that? I said, well, I remember, I think I listened to it on Radio New Zealand years ago and thought, that's terrible. I'm not going to be embalmed. But it's not the case anymore. It's one of those, it absolutely was the case. I mean, in the history of embalming, it was actually Abraham Lincoln he pushed for embalming to become a thing during the Civil War because he was so distraught that so many Civil War dead couldn't return whole to their families. Or if they did, they would just be, you know, decomposed by the time they got to them. So he was probably the first famous person to be embalmed, Abraham Lincoln. And of the five people that figured out who to do it on his body, I think four of them dropped dead within like 3 months because of the toxic chemicals that they put into his body to keep him looking okay. But we've come a long way since then. We've come a very long way. It's pretty fascinating.
Mm. I'd like to talk about cleaning the body. The other day I spoke to somebody who worked in an aged care facility and said their job, after somebody had died, their job was to wash the body. And he said, the first time I did it, I approached it with great trepidation. I was, as you can understand, he had all kinds of difficulties about touching a body. Mm-hmm. He said, as soon as I started doing it, he said, I fell into a kind of trance and I felt that I was doing something sacred. And he said, and that was 20 years ago. And he said, it's never changed. Every time now I approach a dead body to clean it and prepare it, he said, I feel like I'm doing something sacred. And he said,
That's a wonderful, wonderful analogy. It does feel like that. The first, I will never forget this gentleman. He was the first one that, and I was like, okay, this is make it or break it for me. Am I going to cope or am I not cut out for this? And it was such a dignified and graceful and respectful procedure. And I was shown how faces are set and because jaws come open. So, yes, your jaw is stitched, but not actually how you would imagine it. It's quite subtle. And I was quite fascinated by that. And these little bits are popped onto your eye. To stop the eyeballs from sinking, so it can look very odd. And I thought, I don't know if I can cope with this. And I actually approached it, with a lot of trepidation, like your friend that you were talking to. And it turned out to be a lovely thing. The strangest part for me was cleaning and washing this person's hands. I felt like I was holding their hand. It was the oddest thing. None of the other things that you might expect to be disturbing were remotely disturbing, but holding and caressing a very cold, very dead hand, I found oddly intimate, and that stuck in my head that night. It certainly did. But it is almost like a sacred undertaking, I guess, in that respect. And it's a lovely way to see it as doing something sacred. Some cultures, of course, the woman will come and address the body. Some cultures, it's the men. In the Sikh faith, for example, the men will come and wash, prepare, and then dress the body with the five sacred garments. And that's the men's job. So there is something about the act of that last act of love and seeing, and there's a lot of dignity in it. We're very careful to never treat anyone in our care with any lack of dignity. I mean, even if it's just us in the room, there any private parts are covered. It's the person as they were is always in our minds when we're dealing with the person who has died, I guess.
Do the family ever want to participate in the ritual of cleaning the body, preparing the body?
Yes, absolutely. And we have rooms and facilities for that to happen in. If that person is purging or they have open wounds, or then we will pre-prepare them. We generally, before there's the cleaning and the dressing, we've already done that, because things happen to our bodies that are not necessarily, to put it delicately, they're not necessarily how can I explain this without sounding crass? Things leak and dribble, and so we would make sure that if a family wanted to wash and dress the body, it would be done in a private room. We'd have a table, we'd have everything they need there, but we would have already made sure that it was, apart from safe to do so, not too disturbing.
We're talking about purging the bowels and things like that.
No, not necessarily. That just giving them a good wash, making sure that purging does not happen if they're not embalmed. If they're embalmed, that won't happen. But yeah, we do our best to get them to the families. We explain what they need to do. Addressing a person who has died can be quite difficult because they are not going to cooperate, and they may have rigor mortis, or there's an easy way to do it, and there's tricks of the trade, and we help families with that. It's like, okay, what you need to do is you need to, roll them shoulder, hip this way and then back the other way. So we will help with that. And I think it's a really important part of the entire process, that ritual, for a lot of families. And if they don't want to be involved but they'd still like to see their loved one, it can often be, okay, well, you just pick the clothes. Pick what you'd like to see. What clothes would you like him in or her in? You don't need to be involved, but we will, make them look as good as they can. Even that small sort of decision can be quite huge for a lot of families.
Okay,
it's fascinating.
We're rapidly running out of time, Jill. So before I get to my final question, just one quick question. We've mostly talked about cremation and burial.
Mm.
Do you get many requests for a natural burial?
Up where we are, I haven't had any. So sea burial is something that people are starting to talk about, but without wanting to talk on behalf of the entire industry, the legislation that we work within, I think, was last updated in 1956. So there is room for things to change. Things will change, and I'm sure there are the Funerals Directors Association of New Zealand, etc., do lobby for that sort of change to happen, because people are starting to see it. Not so much where I am, but I'm sure it's becoming more prevalent up and down the country, people interested in that natural burial. And what does that mean?
Now, I'd like to finish by asking you some personal questions, if that's okay.
Of course.
Are you afraid of your own death?
I'm not afraid of being dead. The lead up to the actual death is, genuinely frightening, I guess. Well, is it frightening? I think I'm just scared of pain, Andrew. I don't want it to be horrible.
I'd like it to be, but I guess everybody would. My own death, no, not at all. I'd rather make a difference in the life I have now than worry too much about my death.
If you were given a terminal diagnosis and you had 6 months to live and you were aware that the last 2 months you would be in considerable pain, would you opt for assisted dying?
Yes. Yes, I would. Yeah.
What's your,
but that has nothing to, you know, that's no reflection on my profession or anything. I guess it's just, I think it's very, the needless suffering of a lot of people can be alleviated, and I think taking control over your mortality, such as it is, in that circumstance, is a very powerful thing to be able to do.
Jill, the reason why we're doing this series is because we wanted to spark a conversation about death and dying, and Hospice Waikato feels it's something that we as a society generally don't talk about enough, and that by talking about death, we take all the mystery and fear and uncertainty away. And it's actually I found it a very liberating experience.
Isn't it?
Would you like to just finish off by just offering your perspective on that statement, please?
Well, it is the one thing that is going to happen to all of us. And it absolutely needs to be taken out of the box a little bit. I believe that now we're more of a secular society, that we don't have the same religious overtones and fears that were, you know, insurmountable in the past. And it shouldn't be, I believe there should be some mystery and dignity. Death, it is something that you don't come back from. But let's talk about it more so it's not so horrific for people when it happens to somebody they love. Very few people know what to do next. And I guess that's where we come in. People just want to understand next steps, what happens now. And that's what we help with. And like I say, quite often the first time I'll speak to somebody is the worst day of their lives. And they're completely bewildered. If there was sort of more discussion, robust discussion, or even just casual discussion about the mechanisms and the processes and the rituals, I think that would be much less for the people left behind to grieve.
Jill, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Andrew. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.